The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
They say Admiral Harry Cooper is standing by somewhere. Oh, I hope he's sitting down there in Florida somewhere. Have your admiral's? Do you have your admiral's cap on, sir? Sir?
No, as a matter of fact, I was normally dressed all day. Now I'm sitting around in shorts and a t-shirt.
Really?
The other day when I was on with Dick Allgaier, we were recording. A review of Chapter 30 of our book, Space, the Final Frontier. He was shocked when the camera came on. I was wearing my tuxedo, but that's because that was the first time I wore my Knight's Cross. You know, I was knighted and received the
Very
Knight's
good.
Cross first class with Oak Leaf, the highest award they can give.
That is really amazing.
I was just shocked when they took, I'm so humbled. But I figured the first time I wear my Knight's Cross, it better not be on some raggedy-ass T-shirt. So I put on my tuxedo.
Good job.
Allgaier was, oh, man, he says, I put on a nice Aloha shirt. You know, he's in Hawaii. So, but we decided next time we'll just be casual again. So right now, like I say, we don't have cameras. I'm wearing a T-shirt that says something negative about Joe Biden.
So, how dare you? So you've been doing these programs like one on each chapter of the book?
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
And it can all be seen on the website, sharkhunters.com. And up in the upper menu, it says reviews. And people can go there and either click on Hitler in Argentina, when I give a video review, or Space, the Final Frontier. We review each and every chapter. We're up to chapter 30 now. We've only got two chapters to go.
This is a half-hour format? 30 minutes?
No, the first one was only about 60 seconds, and I think the longest one was 26 minutes, and it varies.
I got you.
There was one. Good old Dick Allgaier. He's a part-time musician. He wrote and sang
a
song.
Oh, I know. I heard it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The Ballad of Harry Cooper.
Yeah. So you can hear it in its entirety, and I forgot which chapter it was, 27, 28, something like that. He's a very talented guy.
Very good. No, he is. He's a good man. Well, Clark McClelland, may he rest in peace. Hope
God bless him.
Soaring above all of this madness and looking down at it. I knew Clark for well over 20 years, 25 years.
I met him through you.
Yeah, I bet it was, anyway, whatever. He always had these incredible stories to share, which I wasn't allowed to talk about in many cases.
Which is why he got kicked out of NASA.
I know. Well, I got that book and sent it to you, knowing it would be in the right hands, and you did it. You did great.
We're even selling it in Spanish. I got an order yesterday for that book Spanish. So, you know, people want to learn this this history, and it cost him his pension, and he died penniless in an assisted living facility.
It's a long story, but just for you listeners out there who remember Clark, I had arranged with Clark's absolute permission through a third party to put all of his materials in safe, secure storage. So his he considered them vultures. His family wouldn't get them.
Yep. I see why he considered them vultures.
I had it done. They were all safe. And the family showed up and called the cops and threatened the third party. And third party turned it all over to the family, and that's the end of it. It's gone.
I wish I could have gotten in contact with that third party. I'm sure there are stories there, but that's water under the bridge.
Well, that third party was, anyway. Okay, so Clark McClelland experienced, for all of you out there, just the short story on Clark, he was a NASA scientist. And the Germans, of course, were NASA. They ran NASA. They staffed NASA with the key engineers and technicians and so forth in most of the departments. And the first director of NASA was Hitler's director of rocketry at Peenemünde during the war, Dr. Kurt Debus. And he came over here and ended up as the director of NASA from 1962 to 1973. Look it up. D-E-B-U-S.
Yep.
Dr. Kurt Debus. He was a... according to some people out there, an evil Nazi. Of course he wasn't. He was a scientist. Anyway, they began to hang around together, Clark and the Germans, and they accepted him. They realized he was an honorable man, could keep his mouth shut, and he got to see and hear some incredible things. When the Kecksburg craft went down, they sent him up there, Dr. Debus did, and one other person, and Clark promised me he'd tell me, but then he died, and he didn't tell me who the other person was. We don't know who it was. My guess was Hans Kammler, but I don't know. But Clark met Kammler, K-A-M-M-L-E-R, and if you don't know anything about Hans Kammler, look him up.
Third most powerful man in the Reich.
Yeah, he supposedly died over there and all that crap. No, Clark met him in Florida at NASA. Anyhow, it's quite a story. That's quite a book. And I don't know how much editing you had to do to it and to get it to read better than it did, but I know you did a good job. I've never sat down and read it, to be honest. I just don't have time. But
people who have gotten it really, really enjoy it. And it's available on our website. Go to sharkhunters.com. Click on shop, click on books. They're all there.
Yeah.
And this one
Clark
we're going to talk about tonight, it's rocketing out the door.
Yeah. Did Clark ever give you any of his little, we'll call them mementos for fun?
No, no. He had, by the time I actually met him in Pennsylvania, I shouldn't say met him. I met him here. We used to go to lunch together here, but I guess he had all his stuff stashed somewhere else, and I never even knew what he had until after he was dead, and it was all absconded by his, vultures, yep.
Parasites, vultures, what?
Basically, that's what happens if you are estranged from other parts of your family. When you die, Jesus, they come pouring out of the woodwork like roaches.
Right. It was awful. He told me so many times he didn't want anything to do with them. He didn't want them near his possessions.
Right.
And that's why I ended up putting everything in locked mini storage. Two storage containers with the help of a third party. Now, I don't want to mention who that person was. But
no, I know. I wish I could get a hold of that person. It would, like I say, a lot of stories.
Many, many stories. Another book, actually.
Maybe that person even has some photos. Who knows? I'd love to find. You and I can talk later. Maybe you can give me some information. I'll track that person down, maybe.
Well, that person is down there, so
I'll
see what I can do. Yeah,
right near where Clark lived, which was only 40 miles from me.
Right. Yeah. Okay, well, we did really good getting that book done, and you deserve so much credit, and it's just great. And I remember first time Clark was, he'd always do a chapter and try and sell a chapter during an interview we did here. And I said, Clark, you can't do that. You got to get the book done.
He had, I
think, one or two chapters that he hadn't put in the book when he said it was done. But he admitted to me there was more that he wanted to put in there. He was afraid. I mean, he paid a big price for being friends with the journalists.
He was rightfully afraid.
Yes.
They really messed up his life at the end.
Oh, yeah.
That's sad, too, because he's a very intelligent man. IQ was 161, I believe. And to be treated like a pariah.
Right.
Have everything taken from him.
Right. For those of you who are subscribers, you can go back in the archives and look for Clark McClelland. Those programs are all worthy of your time. He was going through so much pain. He would actually break down in tears sometimes on the program that the pain was that bad.
And, in the midst of our conversations, and also when I was there visiting him in Pennsylvania, about every 4, 5, 6 minutes, he just literally screamed. Hell of a life.
Yeah.
Hell of an ending, I should say.
Well, he got it out in the book for the most part. There was more to it, but did I ever send you the picture of the glass jar?
No, we talked about the glass jar, but
I swear
send me
I
a
did.
Photo. I can slug it into the magazine.
Well, if I can find them, I will. I don't know what might be on.
And for your listeners, Shark Hunters puts out a magazine every month. Go to sharkhunters.com and read up about joining Shark Hunters. It's only $5 a month, and you get that magazine and all sorts of other neat stuff. You've been a member, for 10 years now, haven't you?
Something like that, I guess.
It was 10 years ago this February or March that I was on your show the first time.
Wow. 10 years. Well, I'm honored.
Yeah.
That's nice. One-eighth of your life.
I figure we'll be about another 20 years on your show to come.
Damn well better be.
Because I ain't dying anytime soon.
There's no reason to die. Come on, stop it.
I know it. No, I ain't dying. I'm having too much fun here. I work from about 4:30 in the morning till about 8 at night, as you know, writing books. And this is the newest one that we're going to talk about tonight. Hidden Secrets of World War II, Volume 1. I got to looking at what we have in file, because it's easy to write the books now because these are all sections, articles that we've run in our magazine over the years, and the spook stuff that we're talking about now, these were all things that I've just stuck on the computer because I had to promise I wouldn't let it go for at least 25 years, and it's now been 27 years, so it just copy and paste and slug in a bunch of photos, and I'm even, you know, shocked when I see some of this stuff.
Yeah, wow.
We will see, you know, with some of this.
And don't forget, for all of you listening, Hitler in Argentina, the first book, the definitive book on the truth of the matter of fact that Hitler and Eva Braun did not die in the bunker. Bormann took them out on stretchers, covered up, so no one could see who they were. Everyone in there knew, I think.
And forcibly drugged under Borman's orders.
They were drugged. That's right.
And moved
Hitler
out.
Was going to stay there, yeah, and die there. But yeah. Borman knew that he'd be more valuable alive, and Borman was quite the businessman.
So, oh, he was indeed.
Yeah.
He started, 750 more corporations when he was down in Argentina.
It was huge. It was almost like the Chinese Communist Party, for God's sake.
Yeah.
They have over 20,000 cared. Now.
I don't think Borman cared who was investing in him, but he started 750 corporations. Many of them are still running today. Big, big names.
You know, it's sad that Perón got ousted there. I don't know who was behind it. I haven't studied it for a long time, but
I have no idea.
Stayed in office. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I have no idea. But if I had to put money down, I would bet it was the CIA. They were
right
behind so many uprisings in Latin America. And let's not forget the Iran-Contra deal. The rebels in, Nicaragua or one of those countries down there, that was all being funded by the CIA. Bill Clinton was running drugs in and out of Mena, Arkansas, and that was what was financing this. And Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North was the front man, allegedly. I met him. I spent a little bit of time talking to him. Nice guy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if it ain't the CIA, it would have been the KGB or one of the other spook outfits from different countries, you know, the big countries like Soviet Union, like the United States. Those were the two big players back then. And the Soviet Union had the KGB or some other spook outfit. We had the CIA. And Allende, he got ousted by General Pinochet, and evidence leads to the CIA causing that one. So you never know.
No. All right. The name of the new book is, and let's step into this. you're happy with it.
You've been the Secrets of World War II.
Yeah.
And if you look at your photo array, that's photo number one.
Everyone look in Guess. Look at tonight's guests, and right there, click there, you will see Harry's name. And go under that and look at photos. I'm going to go slow here so everyone can pull them up. Photos. All right, you all ready, everybody? Okay.
Drum roll.
Picture number one.
Picture number one. That's the front cover of the book. And my wife Kay and my daughter Megan helped me design that.
Very good. All right. Well, this it looks like secret documents is what it looks like, which is the idea, and you did it.
Maybe there's a reason it looks like secret documents, because that's what it is.
Yeah. So many things.
We have hundreds and hundreds of those things in file and on the computer. So I just grabbed a bunch of them and cobbled it up like that.
Got it. It's always amazing to think about Don Angel, and if you get the book Hitler in Argentina, you reproduce the whole primary document he gave you. Did you not in the book? It's all there.
Yeah, it was a letter from him explaining everything. It was single-space, typewritten, 114 pages long. That was one hell of a letter. But it detailed how he was working. He was a Spaniard, but he was working for the Abwehr. And then he was posted into the bunker, the Führer bunker, right around the early part of 45. And every day he had to give a report on something to Hitler, so he knew Hitler. And then one day, after the birthday, Hitler's birthday was on the 20th of April, he was there, Dönitz was there, several of the U-boat guys I know were there. And then suddenly, a day or two or three, whatever, later, he and Eva Braun were forcibly drugged under orders of Bormann and removed. So Don Angel went through the whole... Then he went through how he was in Spain. Of course, he was a Spaniard.
Yeah.
And after the war was over, they brought Herr Fleischmann to him. And who was Herr Fleischmann but Bormann? And he had to teach Bormann how to speak Spanish the Argentine way, because Argentine Spanish is actually called Castellano. And in some areas it's normal Spanish. In some areas the pronunciation is very, very different. For instance, LL, if you say V-I-L-L-A, that's Villa in Spanish, right, anywhere you go, but not in
sure.
Argentina. It's Villa. So there are those little oddities, and Don Angel taught
another
him how
one,
to...
Another one. The name Jose is pronounced with a hard J down there, according to at least certain areas. They say Jose or Jose, something like that. They meant they pronounce it differently.
And I don't know why, but it's different. So he taught Bormann how to speak the Argentine Spanish, and then he rode down there with him. In 1946, they came ashore at Puerto Coig, which is way, way, way south Patagonia. And then he worked for the Third Reich, which Martin Bormann was running. He then was based in Mexico City and spying on the U.S. And finally, in 1958, he just said, he was done. He was getting to be an old man. He wanted to go home and spend time with his wife. What a silly thought. Hang around with your wife and kids. And then he and I've never met him, but he and I wrote back and forth quite a bit after he sent me this 114-page long letter. And then he and I wrote back and forth quite a bit. I'm still in contact with his oldest son.
Mm-hmm.
So
who is not being the most cooperative fellow?
Oh, he's being cooperative. It's the son of Schaefer, the skipper of U-977 that surrendered in Argentina 3 months after the war ended. The son there, Pedro Schaefer, he says that I know more about his father and his boat than the son does. And I say, I don't believe that for a minute, because his father stayed down in Argentina after they probably shipped back to the U.S. for whatever. But he became the general manager of Mercedes of Argentina there in Buenos Aires. Mm-hmm. And he... you know, his son was born there. So, but his son doesn't want to talk to me, so there we go. Also, Pizarro's son, that's the one we're talking about.
He's a real... Pizarro's son, that was it.
Yeah, he's a real POS.
Right.
But what can I say? You win some, you lose some.
Right.
And some you give away.
Yes. Precisely. Okay. All right, go ahead. Let's move
forward. Okay. All right, well, let's look at number two, photo number two. Now, I'm going to jump around and talk about a few of the chapters in this book. We're not going to go through every chapter, or we'd be here until dawn. But these are just some. Photo number two, let's see, is number three also part of that? Oh, good. Hit the wrong button. Boy, oh, boy. Shouldn't let me near a computer. Photo number two and number three have to do with chapter seven, the death camps. Now, this is not the evil Nazis that you read about in the propaganda stuff, stuffing people into furnaces. This refers to the Eisenhower starvation camps. Now, before we get too far down the road, don't anybody be saying horrible Americans, all Americans are horrible. No, that ain't the case. Eisenhower, he was a real bastard. And the American soldiers that guarded these camps were not combat guys. And we'll talk about that in a minute. So this chapter comes from a U.S. soldier who demands anonymity. He was drafted in October of 1944. The war was almost over. But he got sent to Germany right at the end of the war. You know, you got to go through boot camp for a while, et cetera. And then he got over there, and he was assigned to a repo depot, as it was called, a replacement depot.
Right.
Now, something you got to keep in mind, he says, and this will come up in a moment or five, non-combat units were ridiculed at that time. Okay, that's part of why this happened, I think. He had 4 years of high school German, and he was able to talk to the prisoners, and then he got in a jam for that because you're not supposed to talk to the prisoners. At the place he was, Andernach prison, there were about 50,000 held in open field, surrounded by barbed wire. The women were kept in a separate enclosure. He says, the men I guarded had no shelter, no blankets. Most had no coats. They slept in the mud, wet and cold, with inadequate slit trenches for excrement. It was a cold, wet spring, and their misery from exposure was evident. He goes on to say, it was even more shocking to see prisoners throwing grass and weeds into a tin can to make thin soup.
You understand, everyone, this was all done under the orders of that great war hero, Dwight David Eisenhower.
Who
one
never
of the
got
most
near
inhuman,
combat.
Subhuman pieces of crap you'd ever want to meet on this planet, if you'd want to meet him at all.
Well, if you're a good person and go to heaven, you won't. He says, quickly they became emaciated, dysentery raged, and soon they were sleeping in their own excrement because they were too weak to get up. They were
this
begging
is a true,
for food.
A true holocaust of humanity, yes.
Oh, yeah. And he said, we had ample food and supplies, but we couldn't give anything to them, including medical assistance. Couldn't give it to them. He protested to his officers and was, I'm reading out of the chapter, he was met with hostility from his officers. And they explained they were under strict orders from higher up to do this. He realized his protests were useless, so he asked a friend who worked in the kitchen if he'd slip me some extra food for the prisoners. And his buddy didn't want to, but he finally talked him into it. He threw food over the barbed wire to the prisoners, got caught, and was threatened with imprisonment. One officer threatened to shoot him, an American. So
we're the good guys.
Yeah. And he said he encountered a captain overlooking the area where the German civilian women were and was shooting at him with his .45 caliber pistol. So this soldier asked him why he was doing it, and he said, target practice. So,
unbelievable.
Yeah, let's see, here we go. He said this is his words. This is when I realized I was dealing with cold-blooded killers filled with moralistic hatred. Here we go. This goes along with the first thing I told you to remember. He says here, and I believe this, I've said this all along, but this guy says, I think soldiers who were not in combat were trying to prove how tough they were by taking it out on the prisoners and the civilians, and that's what I've said all along. These were not combat soldiers. The American combat soldiers had a lot of respect for the German counterparts. But
they wouldn't have gone
the guys who were never in combat felt that they had been cheated, they didn't get into combat, and so there were, and like I said at the beginning of this chapter, the non-combat units were ridiculed. So, prisoners were as eager for cigarettes as for food. That was the way it was back in them days. Everybody had to smoke. So, enterprising GI Yankee traders, as he puts it in parentheses, were acquiring hordes of watches and rings in exchange for handfuls of cigarettes or less. These poor guys not only didn't have food or medicine, they were trading off their watches and rings for the little bit. And then he says he began throwing cartons of cigarettes, the soldier that wrote this, to the prisoners to try to ruin the black market trade. He was threatened to get his ass kicked by the rank-and-file soldiers. He said one night he was put on the so-called graveyard shift, 2 to 4 in the morning. And he said there was a graveyard on the uphill side of the enclosure. And he didn't have a flashlight. And he was just sitting there on a very bright night. And he suddenly became aware of a prisoner crawling under the wire toward the graveyard. And he said, we were supposed to shoot escapees on sight. So I started to get up to warn him to get back. And he noticed another couple more crawling out from under the wire. And they went to the cemetery. And he tripped over the legs of somebody laying there. And he had the rifle, but he didn't fire. He saw, I'm reading his chapter, I saw the beautiful but terror-stricken face of a woman with a picnic basket nearby. German civilians were not allowed to feed or even come near the prisoner. So he told her in his German that she didn't need to be afraid. He was getting out of their way. So this poor guy, like he's trying to push a string up a hill, because all these worthless bums who never got into combat were killing people just for fun. So he decided to celebrate with some prisoners. They were baking bread, and they went into the French zone, and he said they soon witnessed the brutality of the French soldiers when they gave the prisoners over to the French for slave labor camps. This is me talking now. A good friend of ours, who was like, he and his wife were like grandma and grandpa to my kids. He was on board U-315, and they were up in Trondheim when the war ended. And it was 3 months before they got sent back to Germany, so it was like October. And they were on a train from, I think it was Wilhelmshaven, he came in, and they went to Frankfurt. A whole train full of German prisoners from the Oberwaffe. And the train stopped on the west side of the Rhine, and it was surrounded by American guards. And so his friend said, you know, my parents' house is only a few blocks from here. Let's go over there and have something to eat. And so they were allowed to get off the train and go over there. They were not, you know, because they still didn't get their discharge papers, so they weren't able to get a job if they didn't have the American discharge papers. So they went over to his house. They had a big meal, and his friend says, to hell with it. I ain't going back to the train. Detlev says, oh, we have to. You know, the Shermans, alles in Ordnung. Everything has to be done properly. Detlev says, oh, I must go back to the train. So they gave him a bag of food, and he also had a bag of clothing. So he went back on the train, and he's sitting there, and all of a sudden the train moves, and it went across the Rhine River to the east side. And now the guards are around there are French Moroccan and French Senegalese. And then the train went down to the south of France. They had been sold. They were selling prisoners, for God's sake. And he got stuck into a camp on the south of France, a slave labor camp. And they immediately snatched his bag of clothes, but they didn't take his food. So he was better off than some of them. But when he got, they just stuck him into the camp. And no place to go, no buildings, no nothing. They're sleeping on the ground. And an old sergeant told him, if you want to be alive in the morning, dig a foxhole. So he dug the foxhole, and he said about 2 o'clock in the morning, you could hear the machine guns. They were raking the camp 6 inches off the ground, and anybody who wasn't in a hole was dead. And every morning, he said, they'd be hauling dead bodies out of there. And then they'd come
This is as disgraceful a chapter in military history as you're going to find. Over 1 million people were slaughtered under the orders of Eisenhower. A million innocent men. And they weren't given proper POW status because there was only a cessation of hostilities. There was never a formal peace treaty.
Well, that's true, too. But prisoners of war have to be afforded certain benefits, but Eisenhower changed their classification since they were not captured in combat. They surrendered after the war, so he referred to them as disarmed enemy forces or surrendered enemy forces or something like that, which had no protection under the Geneva Convention. And even if it did, so what? We were the winners. We had all the power, and Eisenhower at that time was the most powerful man in the world. So, what can I say? Like I said, it's not America. It's not the United States. It's not Americans. It was Eisenhower and just a bunch of sadistic people that wanted to take out their frustrations on helpless people. Those people are in hell, too. If you lead a good life and go to heaven, you won't meet those guys.
No. No, we see, the saddest thing is that American men and women who fought this war under false pretenses by way of the government lies about who the evil enemy really was. And George Patton, our greatest general, told it very straightforwardly at the end of the war. You can't dismiss what the man said. He said, we fought the wrong enemy. He realized we were duped. And all these men and women who put out so much, the men who died, the men who suffered, the women who were building airplanes, and on their work, their efforts, their patriotism was all being done under completely false circumstances. They didn't know it. It was a fraud. The
no,
whole
of
thing
course
was a
not.
Fraud.
And we suffered in this country, too. Like I sent an email to somebody whose parents lived through the war in Germany. Okay, here in the United States, we were not being bombed. That's true. But everything was rationed. There were no cars built between 41 and 46. So if you didn't have a car, you were stuck. And everything was rationed. We had macaroni and cheese every damn night for supper, to where I hate macaroni and cheese. The few 3 or 4 nights a month we could have meat was Spam. Nobody knew what the hell Spam was. I still don't know what it was, but to this day I won't eat macaroni and cheese. In the morning, you know, my folks and my kid's sister and I were just little teeny kids. We lived with my grandparents in Chicago in their flat, a 3-bedroom flat. Nanny and granddad, mom and dad, me and my sister. And mom and my grandma would make Friday. They'd cook bacon first, then cook the eggs in the bacon grease, which is the way you used to do it. But then they'd pour the bacon grease into a can, and when they got a full can, you know, like a number 10 can, when they got it full of bacon grease, they'd take it down to a collection point. We had collection points all over the city, all over the country, and bacon grease was used in explosives. If you had old tires, you brought them down there because the government would reuse them, cut them up and reuse them. Old clothes, you bring everything you didn't need, you took down there.
Yeah,
and you
recycle
took the
America.
Bus to work.
That's right.
Yeah, right. You took the bus to work, and instead of ripping Americans off with ridiculous income taxes, they sold war bonds. Everybody went to the movies at least on Saturday because there was no TV, and that's where you got the news. You had movie tone news and all that other stuff. As you walked out of the theater, they had a booth set up in every theater to buy war bonds, and that paid for the war. Now, of course, you just rip us off with the taxes. So it was rough on everybody's point. It was 1946 before my folks could even get a house. They bought a house out in a suburb of Chicago. We weren't, like I say, we weren't being bombed, thank God. But nobody had anything. And my dad...
All predicated on lies, all predicated on fraud.
Sure.
The whole damn war.
Yeah. So, anyhow, back to this soldier's...
Story, yeah.
Let's see. Somebody would say, when he'd complain about it, somebody would say, so what? The enemy's atrocities were worse than ours.
Oh,
come on. What a stupid logic.
Not logic.
And this guy goes on to say, the German opportunity for atrocities had faded while ours was at hand. So, he says, rather than copying others' crimes, we should aim once and for all to break the cycle of hatred and vengeance that has plagued and distorted human history. Yeah, how's that working out? And he said, that's why I'm speaking out now, 45 years after this crime. So, I had to wait until that veteran began his eternal patrol before I released his story.
Right.
And he's long gone now. God bless him.
There were several who wrote, and there might even have been a book written by one of the American guards, so to speak. They weren't guarding anything but people who were being slowly and sometimes more quickly executed, murdered.
Yeah.
This is cold-blooded murder. Murder.
Mm-hmm.
The first book on it was called Other Losses. By Canadian author James Bach, B-A-C-Q-U-E.
Right. And if he's passed away now. I just had a conversation with his wife 2 months ago.
Ah, yeah. Well, he did a very, very important thing by bringing that data out in that book. And
he sure did. Yeah. He called me when he was about to start that book about 25 or so years ago and told me what he was doing. I told him I thought it was an awesome project and that... And cheered him on. He wanted to talk to some of our members, but that, you know, German veterans, that never went anywhere. But all his papers
he did a marvelous thing. Because
he did. All his papers are at the university up there in Calgary, I think. I'm not sure where it is, but...
Right.
Yeah, he brought it to light. 1.1 million, in his estimate, Germans were starved to death under Eisenhower's direct orders. I was, as you know, I was in the ruins, remains of one of those camps, thanks to our friend Jeff Carson.
Yeah.
And all the grave markers were around July or August of 45, just long enough to starve to death. And
Eisenhower should have been court-martialed and executed for this on international military justice.
Yeah, but you can't say justice.
No, the winners write the story anyway. So
that's right. All Germans were Nazis. They were all murderers, etc. If you want to believe the propaganda, we
Point
were the
fact,
good guys. We wore the white hats.
Right. Point of fact, less than 10%. I don't know how much less. Less than 10% of all Germans who enlisted and fought in the German military in World War II, all branches, were members of any party, let alone the party. They were apolitical. Yeah, they were patriots. They were defending
the Navy,
their country.
They were not allowed to belong to any party. Dönitz, no. When he took over from Raeder, he made it a rule. Nobody in the Navy could belong to any party at all. And then after the July 1944 attempt on Hitler's life, then they did have a political officer on board a lot of the U-boats, but some of them unfortunately got left up on the bridge when the submarine dived.
Well, they were kind of sneered at and hated as if they were a reflection of a commissar in the Soviet military, a
pretty
political
much.
Enforcer. And that didn't go anywhere with the enlisted men. Men on all fronts, all armies, both sides, all three sides of the war, very brave, honorable men, most of them, and gave their lives in many cases, or a limb, or they were wounded. For what, Harry? For what? For the globalist elite and their decision that Germany and Germans had to be destroyed. This had been going on since World War I. Don't ever forget
that. I was just going to say that. Yeah, World War I, World War II was all to wipe out Germany, and right now it's just been re-educated.
Right.
I had lunch yesterday with a good friend of mine who was German-born, and he's an American citizen now. And his words yesterday at lunch, he said, Germany is no more. Europe is no more, he said.
No, and tune in 6 to 12 months and you'll see even less, lots less.
Believe it.
This whole thing is being done to destroy Western Europe, Western culture, the Western people. And it's all from, and includes Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, the U.S., the U.K., and Western Europe.
Right. Well, Australia and New Zealand, that's all Western Europe anyhow. That was originally a political or a prison colony down there.
So, yeah, well, they've been very hard on the New Zealanders and the Australian people. It's almost like a beta test to see how far they can push them, how blatant their aggression against human rights can go, God-given rights.
The Prime Minister of New Zealand, I think, just resigned. I saw on television the New Zealand Prime Minister resigned.
Yeah, I know. Jacinda Ardern, she's going out, I think February 6th is her last day or something. Just an outright Bolshevik.
Yeah.
She's a Bolshevik communist bitch is all she is. Horrible.
Oh, okay.
Horrible.
Don't hold back. Tell us what you really think.
Oh, okay. let me think about it. No, I know people that live there. They hate
it. Yeah, we've got members down there, too.
Anyway.
I'm learning to speak Australian.
Yeah. So
g'day,
she's
mate.
Out. Pardon me?
Yeah. G'day, mate.
Oh, yeah.
Go and get into my ute and go to the bottle low for a slab. That means I'm getting in my truck and driving to the liquor store for a case of beer.
God. All true. All true. All right. So the book contains, give us a quick, we got 2 minutes. Give me an overview of the kinds of things that are in the book.
Okay. Well, I'll go down chapter by chapter quickly.
Materials that are shown on the cover. And you can just run down the chapters. Sure.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Chapter one, propaganda radio broadcasts in the Atlantic to demoralize the U-boaters. Chapter 2, Axis Sally. 3, was there U-boat supply in the Caribbean? 4, radio station Atlantic, which was more propaganda. 5, Antarctica. One of our members, dead now, was Admiral Byrd's adjutant. Chapter 6, German-Japanese cooperation. Number 7, death camps. We were talking about that. Number 8, the great SS charade. 9, SS and the Gestapo in France. 10, Argentina's place in the war. 11, this is a good one, MK Ultra. 12, I call it paintings by Rembrandt. Rembrandt was one of our Sieg agents who was in Dutch intelligence. A lot about Kammler and Mengele. Let's see. 14, what is Colonia Dignidad? I think we've touched on that. 15, more spook stuff in Latin America. 16, the Falkland Islands, Islas Malvinas. Why Admiral Graf's Bay attacked those islands. So that's a wrap-up in it, and those who have gotten it so far, they are just, they can't put it down, they said.
I believe it. How many more do you think you got data to produce?
I have, so far, and I'm still adding to it, I've got 500 chapters of either spook stuff or U-boat stuff.
Oh, my.
Plus another couple hundred chapters for the flyboy stuff.
The hidden history of World War II.
Yep.
And after. Wow.
We're going to have volume 2, 3, 4, 5 as fast as I can put them together. And this is all hard fact. Nothing, not like the U-boat dot not, as the U-boat guys called them laughingly, or any of these internet sites that work with speculation, theory, deduction, etc. These are all right from the people who were there. The people who fought the war, the warriors. Both sides, American as well as German, some Italian, some British, some Soviet. In the Flyboy books, which we haven't put this part out yet, we got, I think, 6 or 7 chapters by Russian pilots who were flying MiG-15s in Korea when I was
against
a teenager.
F-86s. How wild
is
that?
That's right. We had Sabre jets over there, and they had MiG-15s. Yeah. And when I was a teenager during Korean War, there was everybody suspected that the Russians were flying the MiGs and not the Koreans. And now, it came out many years later, and we got 6 different chapters by 6 different Soviet MiG pilots telling about their exploits and how they've tangled with the Sabre jets. These are all secrets that...
Fascinating.
Most people don't know.
The hidden history of World War II. Wow. Well, this is going to be a truly major achievement and an accomplishment for you, but beyond that, you're going to present the world with things that otherwise would be lost in the sands of time. Never be heard from. Never. This is so important. Oh, very good. All right, we got to run. We're going to take a break. Come right back with Admiral Harry Cooper and continue our second hour. A lot of pictures to look at and things to talk about.
Yeah, we're going to have to talk fast to get it all in.
Yeah, we'll do it.